Live from the Pathway Studios in Johnston proper, you are Live from the Path.
You're listening to Live from the Path on livefromthepath.org, broadcasting every Monday night, somewhere around 10. I think we've hit it this week, boys. We put the golf ball on a tee, and we took a whiff, and we made some connection. All right. So it is around the 10 o'clock hour on a Saturday night. We're broadcasting live on the interwebs. We're also, if you're listening to the terrestrial radio, you're listening on 99.3 KTIA in Des Moines. And so we're glad to have you with us. We got all kinds of stuff going on today. I was looking at an article earlier on Christianity Today, which I will be honest with you, I do not peruse often. I only went there because Ben seems to pull some kind of stuff off of this place every once in a while. And so I took a look at it, and there was an article that angered me. And I thought they've written the headline just to irritate me. And it was entitled, "We Should Expect Non-Christians to Share Our Morals," which I believe I've said the complete opposite multiple times. And so we're going to have a read through that and see where I disagree, along with you other fellas. I was also reading through Relevant Magazine, had an article entitled, "Six Reasons You Seriously Need to Slow Down." And this one I found a lot more helpful. It had there's a lot of times when I think things are going a little bit too fast, and everything's rush, and there's something wrong, but I don't know why. I couldn't really put my finger on it. I think they did a pretty good job hitting that on the head. So we're going to go through those two things along with some Dear Life from the Path. I think Dave Herrick's got some some things on how God's been fooling with your prayer life.
Yeah, he's been turning it upside down and just reshaping my focus. And it's been pretty wonderful. It's a little bit terrifying, but all in all pretty awesome. So I'll let you guys get a peek on that one.
Yeah, I suppose when the Lord tries to turn you upside down, that's good times.
Yeah.
You know, it's like a spiritual roller coaster.
Pretty much.
It sounds like it's a good time.
It's about like an earthquake. It's like, you know, all of a sudden this ground that you have always thought of as very stable is suddenly moving, and you're like, wait a minute, there's something dynamic going on that I'm just not used to at all.
You know, I never have had that reaction to an earthquake where I'm standing and I think, you know, something dynamic's going on here.
But there's some really big stuff happening in my life right now.
I do like your calm approach to natural disasters, Dave. And, Boo, you got some Pope-style advice?
I do. And, man, every once in a while, I have to stop and remind myself that I feel like I haven't given anything to God in a while. Like, I honestly don't feel like I've given anything up or given anything to God in a while. And that needs to change.
He lacks presence.
He does.
Okay, good. I'm interested to hear Boo's Pope-style advice on either giving stuff or taking stuff away. I also parent that same way, so that's very good. All right, we're going to hit this. Before we get too far into the show is brought to you by Bob Eisenlauer with the Eisenlauer Team. It's EisenlauerTeam.com for all your real estate needs. They are easy to work with, .. hard to beat. And that's the truth. I've used them personally, Bob in particular, to help sell my house and help me find another one. And hands down, it was super easy. I kind of had this thing coming into it where I thought it was going to be a disaster. There were going to have to be like 15 bloviated conversations about real estate that I didn't give two rips about. But I showed up. I said, here's the house I want. He goes, great, I'll get you keys. Go look at it. I'll get the paperwork started. And it was just that easy. It was great. So there's no reason to, you know, struggle with your house on the market for 10 months trying to, you know, squeeze an extra $500 out of it. Just let them price it for you. Let them look at it. They know the market better than you do. It's the only way to go. So that's Bob Eisenlauer with the Eisenlauer Team. He's always been a great friend of the show. So here we go. We're going to check out this article called "We Should Expect Non-Christians to Share Our Morals," found on Christianity Today. So I'm going to do a little reading here, and then we're going to have at it and see if we agree with what this guy's saying. He says, "A common reaction among evangelicals to the June Supreme Court ruling on the same-sex marriage has been deflection from controversy." First of all, what's an evangelical? Hit me again. What does it mean?
Someone who's oriented their faith around the gospel.
And is that more detailed than, say, if I were just to say Baptist, Lutheran, denomination style? Or does that include all of those?
It includes a wide variety of denominations. I believe Baptists are in there, some of the other, like evangelical freeze in there.
Generally, you're more conservative Bible churches.
Gotcha. Yeah, they're very Bible-oriented. Some of the others are going to be a little more church or tradition or theologically oriented in some way or another.
Now, see, I always thought that the evangelical free was an odd name for a denomination because it's very much like sugar-free gum. That means there's no sugar there. And so when people say I'm evangelical free, I thought, well, that's a weird statement. Are you that against evangelicals?
We're free of evangelicals in this church.
You define who you are by what you're not. I thought it was weird. Anyway, okay, so evangelicals include people that follow, basically follow the Bible and center their faith around the Gospels.
Yeah.
Okay, love it. Okay, so basically a common reaction among evangelicals to the Supreme Court ruling on same-sex marriage has been deflection from controversy. This laissez-faire approach has been most commonly expressed by closely connected beliefs about Christianity and morality. One, we should not expect non-Christians to think and live like Christians. So why all this fuss among Christians over the legalization of same-sex marriage? Two, since when do we depend on the government to enforce Christian morals? He's got me there. I agree with both of those. Mm-hmm. Many who express these sentiments do so with well-meaning attempts to rightly keep evangelicals from panicking over misplaced trust in temporal earthly powers. Additionally, they want to remind themselves and fellow believers to be a Christ follower will always be, as Jesus promised, countercultural. Here comes the big old but. Yet, the two statements above reflect a poor understanding of how God ordered creation, morality, and the purpose he has given civil law. Assumptions like those above can lead to disastrous consequences for how we understand moral obligation. So let's see what his point is here.
All right.
In one sense, the Bible does describe the condition of humans without Christ as lost and depraved, incapable of pleasing God. Apart from Christ, we are in a state of rebellion, and until regenerated by the Holy Spirit, cannot understand the ways of God. It should not surprise us, then, when sinners act sinfully. Sin has been the human default since Eden. However, by keeping the spotlight only on sinful humanity's inability to live lives of obedience unto God, we overlook how failure to obey God shows that God's commands for human obedience are grounded in his good and holy nature, and therefore obligatory on all persons at all times. Morality reflects God's holiness. Thus, one function of the moral order is to expose our rebellion against God's moral law and God himself. Do we believe that morality reflects God's holiness? I kind of thought this was the center part of the debate, is morality seems to be up for debate on what the source of morality is.
Yeah, I think that's kind of what it comes down to, is why would we expect a person to engage and agree with our sense of morality if they don't agree with the base of our morality, which is ultimately God. So if they're already, you know, rejecting God in their lives, then why would they, by extension, follow his ways?
I think evangelicals, I would put myself in that category, confuse the issue sometimes is we are not Israel, right? You look at the Old Testament scriptures and they're, sometimes you knew the voice and tell the country to get back to God because they were God's people. They were God's chosen covenant people. With a purpose. We are America, which is not the people of God. We just happen to be a country based on some ideals of God. That's really great. But we're not like God's chosen people, right? So to tell the country to get back to God is like they never were there,
yeah.
Right? There happen to be some Christians, some Christ followers help form the place. And there's always been plenty around here, but we're not a Christian nation.
Well, and actually, like if going from the basis of creation, Israel was always set apart, right? Like,
right.
And so to say, like the like holiness, morality reflects holiness, and like that is something new. That is not new. The otherwise there would never have been the Jebusites and the Hivites and everybody else that was not Israel, right? And so basically saying like within your culture, within your sphere, or let's say your clan known as Christians, people that follow Jesus, yeah, morality is to be upheld. Mm-hmm. Very similar to Israel, right? But outside of that, like I don't recall anything straight out of the Old Testament was like, and by the way, get the Jebusites. Because they're, you know what I'm saying? Like impose these laws I've given you in, say, Deuteronomy and go impose them on the Jebusites. They were imposed to set those specific group of people apart. That morality was imposed to set those people apart and very well reflect God's holiness, right? But like, I don't know. I don't see how that reaches all the way out to your culture in a healthy way.
I mean, there were times you were to go and like, Jonah went out to Nineveh, pagan culture, telling them, "Hey, you'd better repent because God, has these expectations of you."
But not on the basis of morality, right?
Yeah,
like you need to know God, and with God comes these.
Right.
This
what
way
I'm
of living.
Like we still have a voice, but we shouldn't. To expect them to act like they love God when they don't even know Him, is ridiculous.
That's the thing. In the long run, they're just going to shine it on, Mm-hmm. Right? Like, when faced with a choice of changing your life in hard ways to equal a good output or phoning it so people will leave you alone, 9 out of 10 people will go with phony it, leave me alone. Mm-hmm. It's just easier, right? It's the easier output. I want you to stop yelling at me and to think this way about me, so I will act this way in front of you, so you'll stop with this beratement. And but we'll see. He's got more to say. I'm cutting him to the quick here. Okay. Here, let's see what else he says. He says, we know the moral order is good because our guilty conscience indict us for failing to uphold it. This is the most basic of ethical principles. To say non-Christians can't be expected to live like Christians and obey God ignores the fact that God and the moral order he implanted in creation are to be obeyed. Making that claim leads to a consequence similar to what happens when we quit a book halfway in. We'll fail to see the full story and resolution.
It seemed like the basis of his argument there was they feel guilty, so they inherently know that it's wrong or right based on guilt. I kind of have trouble with that.
Yeah, I
believe because wouldn't that be that in Romans? Kind of. I mean, I think that's what he's probably coming from—the conscience, you know.
Yeah, but
conscience exists. But if we're basing that as a human condition, then we wouldn't be in the situation we're in.
Yeah, because really, if that was the truth, then the laws would never be necessary.
Right, exactly.
Right? If your conscience automatically just convicted you based on God's principles, then we would never
see the laws. We'd all be on the same page. It's like, oh, man, whether you're my deity or not, I know I messed up again. Sorry, God or other thing.
Yeah, it wouldn't be a shock that you can't have 7 wives. You know what I'm saying? And treat people poorly. Everyone would already know that, and we would have no reason to write it down.
It's like, wait a minute, murder? Not okay? All right, fair enough.
I mean, I think I get what he's getting at, but I mean, that's just flat out not true, right? Like, the same behavior that hurts my heart when it happens does not hurt the heart of the man next to me. Mm-hmm. And he will continue engaging in said behavior without a feeling about it either way.
And besides, we always end up justifying ourselves in our own actions anyway, so even though we can see something wrong in someone else, when we look back at ourselves, we say, well, yeah, but I had to do it because of reasons.
There was extenuating circumstances.
Yeah.
Which my morality agreed with.
Yeah.
So, let's see. Blah, 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 blah. Every human, even in a fallen world, has some capacity to do good. This is often referred to as common grace. That is, God's restraining us from being completely evil, and his enabling us to do good, though not unto salvation. Now, see, I also disagree with that, as that was not my opinion of what common grace was. Hmm. As far as I was concerned, common grace is, look, you've all sinned and fallen short of the glory of God. Your punishment is death. The common grace is, I have not killed all of you. That's kind of what I saw common grace to be. Hmm. Because really, that was really the breakdown of what sin is. The punishment for being apart from God and is a sinful behavior is death. That's laid out pretty well. And he says, I'm giving grace to everyone that I don't kill you immediately at, say, age 2, when you've decided to be, or 6 months, depending on what type of evil you are, and you've made some kind of rebellion against God. And so that was my, not, I did not think as common grace was restraining us from being completely evil. Okay, excellent. We're hitting on all kinds of points here. We agree with everything this man says. Hang on, we'll give him one more paragraph, and then we're going to have to bail on him. Let's see. He goes on to say, imagine we took the same approach with a different issue, say crime, that some do with marriage and family policy. What if our approach toward murder or theft was laissez-faire? Why should we expect our neighbors not to murder? Why should we think non-Christians will act like believers and obey the sixth commandment? But if the home of one of these advocates were broken into by an unbelieving neighbor, they would call upon the local, God-ordained authorities and accusing the thief of violating a fundamental principle of justice that all of our conscience know to be true. It's just unjust to steal. Stealing is a violation not only of God's revealed law, but also of the basic concept of justice that is written on the heart of every person. If our unbelieving neighbor steals from us, we don't accuse their behavior because they don't follow a Christian code of ethics. We simply expect them not to steal. So how is that different?
I think we can agree on certain issues. I think that everyone's kind of on the same page, for the most part, with murder and with stealing. And
yeah, but why though, Booba?
That I would agree with is a conscience. That is, people understand the concept of what's right and wrong in some situations.
Yeah, but
it's not fair to say that across all avenues. It's not fair to say that conscience is universal enough for us to agree on everything. However, I wouldn't say that conscience isn't universal to agree on some things.
So so if I was sitting in his chair, my counterargument would be, well, where did this conscience come from? And if it came from God, why would it only hit, say, some of his commandments and not all?
Well, I mean, in that in and of itself, you've got the social norms of most people teach their kids that murder's not okay.
Which is, I don't want to die, therefore I should not kill somebody else.
Right. So some of those things are environmental that are instilled upon us. Some of those are social that are instilled upon us. We would argue that conscience comes from God, but the non-believer would not argue that. And they would say that I have a conscience, I don't believe in your God, but that doesn't mean I don't believe that murder's okay. Conscience can cover some things, but it can't cover all. Whether it be a conscience that comes from social norms, from your environmental norms of what you have learned is okay and is what is not okay from your parents or from your environment and surroundings in general, but conscience cannot be called to be universal for all things, or none of us would disagree. So I think some of the things are covered under conscience. Hmm. Just not everything.
You know, if someone was trying to break into the house, I wouldn't be looking through the phone book saying which one of these governing authorities is actually God-ordained and pick that one. I think I would just call the police, whether God ordained them or not.
Well, this man claims that all authority is God-ordained. So any type, well, I've seen wings of our government that I feel are not God.
Yeah, I don't think that's true. I think that's a naive statement that all authority is given from God.
I don't know that lawyers are from God, and people call lawyers a lot to resolve conflicts as well. So
yeah, I can fire somebody at my job because I'm a manager, but that doesn't mean that my authority is God-ordained.
Hmm. I feel like we just fundamentally disagree with this man on just about every aspect.
Yeah,
so far.
Yeah. I mean, here's the deal. You know, I think I get basically what he's saying is that we're not made to roll over and die. And basically he's saying that the morals that God has instilled in creation, it would be to everyone's benefit if you followed them. Well, mm-hmm. I mean, to be honest, that's kind of our sales pitch anyway.
Yeah.
Right? The God who created the world has said, look, I want you to be back in harmony with what I've done. I want you to be back to the world that I created for you that's gotten all fouled up. And the closest thing I can offer you is to follow what I'm saying until I come and straighten this out. And that's our sales pitch anyway. And so I feel like there's not a lot of people – I don't think it's a cop-out to say, listen, their behavior is reflective of them not knowing Jesus, a.k.a. what I hope to be, and the Holy Spirit, what I hope to be, my version of a conscience most of the time, right? Like, the things that don't bother me in my sinful flesh do bother the Holy Spirit. And the Holy Spirit says, yeah, you need to tone that down. That's got to end. That part of you needs to die. And so, you know, the point that he's trying to get across is basically the morals that God instilled with us are nothing to be ashamed of, and I agree. They are not anything to be ashamed of. Although I would not expect people who don't know the source of that morality to follow it for any reason.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I have this kind of muddy swirl in my brain. I'm trying to think this through. So I'll say it out loud, and you guys maybe help me clear the mud. I'm trying to distinguish what he's really saying here. We, you know, as the church, as people of God, we unapologetically teach the morals of God, whether it be sexual purity, murder, lying, stealing, the whole thing, all right? So within the community of believers, within those who call themselves the kingdom of God, that is our standard, that's what we teach. We also live in a culture that's outside of that kingdom. It would be great and to their benefit if they followed those. However, it's not surprising to us. Name your vice. You know, we say, oh, everyone knows murder is wrong. Well, you know, but it's not surprising when someone murders someone, because that's been happening forever since Cain and Abel, right? You know, there are people who disobey God. So it's not a shock to me that they would do that, but we still teach against it. Am I making any sense? You know what I'm saying? I'm trying to figure out. It seems like he's kind of picking and choosing both sides of this.
He's having trouble with expectations here. It's like he's looking at the pagan world and still expecting them to somehow on some level connect with God's law, even though they haven't connected with God.
And it'd be great, but it's not. Why would you expect that?
I wouldn't expect that, but that's but that is what I want to present. After all, the law's a reflection of his character, and what I'm trying to do is just reveal God in who he is. That includes his law and his ways. And so, as I'm going out and trying to say, hey, here's how awesome God is, that includes a discussion on morals and ethical behavior and how living in his will is better. And it's not going to connect with everyone. I get that. But to go in expecting and assuming that it must connect with everyone, I don't know. It just seems a little bit weird.
Yeah. Well, I'm frankly, if you want to boil that down to an example that I think is a little bit more palatable, I try to do the exact same thing with my kids, right? If I just tell them, this is the rule, you will follow it, I expect you to do this, all I will get is a blind obedience with no heart and with no lesson learned and no character built, right? It will just be, I'm doing this because I don't want to get in trouble. And really, when you hold people to standards that they don't understand, that have no root, and you can tie that into any number of parables that Jesus told, like when you try to you know, give it something and make it top heavy with a bunch of rules that it doesn't understand, is not built to support, it will shine it on until it fails, and then it will rebel against it. And so it's just flat out foolish. Now I think he's trying to say on the opposite side that we're giving people a free pass to act how they will. And that their behavior is maybe not acceptable, but it's understandable based on the fact that they don't know Christ. And I would agree with the point he's trying to get rid of. I think that is completely true, is that I, while their behavior is not acceptable, I do understand it. I do understand that with, you know, the buckets that they're pulling from, the life experiences that they're pulling from, and maybe some of the teachings that they've received outside of the Word of God, I would probably have made the same poor, destructive decision. And so, you know, I just patently disagree. I feel like the first two questions or the first two statements he made at the beginning of the article about what evangelicals usually say, that is what I usually say, and I still agree. Okay, well, I think we're done with that, Dan. Yeah. That was for Christianity Today. You can read the whole article. I think that's about 3 pages long. It takes a lot of, and there's a lot of blah, blah, blah in there. I skipped most of it, to be honest with you. I think we got what he was fishing after. Or I've characterized it in such a way that we could mock it for 15 minutes. So either way.
That is a common, passionately held view, too.
What's that?
The point of view that article's written in.
Well, it seems like a selfish point of view because you have an agenda you want to push, right? Like generally they hold that point of view because they have a group that's willing to say, we're going to impress this in an organized way on your local government, on your federal government, on your any institution that you're part of. Get behind our organization. Mm-hmm. Like, that's how I generally see it being done.
And I think I've been there, all right? So I can identify with the passion and the heartbreak of watching some of these big laws change and society completely changing and flipping upside down and calling evil good and good evil. I mean, it's totally right before our eyes happening. And at some point, I had to look at that, this is what's going on, and say, I'm looking at it all wrong. You know, I'm more worried about the law than I am the kingdom of God. I'm worried about protecting some written documents that maybe were influenced by godly people in the past that culture wasn't following anyway. And instead of making disciples, which will get them back to God in the first place. You know, my I had to come to terms with the fact that I'm looking at the wrong thing. And that's what helped me. And that's probably where the other side comes from, you know, because I'm definitely on the other side now, saying that I don't really care what the law is. You know, it doesn't affect me. It doesn't affect my mission as a follower of Jesus. It doesn't affect anything other than it's just telling culture, go ahead and do what you're doing anyway. It's a reflection of where we're at.
Yeah, too often we see people that are trying to turn America into God's kingdom, and that's not the way that it is. We need to realize that we need to completely betray America, run away from it, and run to God's kingdom.
It's the lazy way.
Yeah.
This is the law making to people, so I don't have to.
Yeah, exactly. If we spent the time we did in trying to make some kind of legislature happen to where America is a more moral America, we spent that time making honest disciples out in the world and spending that time seriously talking to people about Jesus, we would no longer be having these conversations. We'd no longer try and fix the legislature. We would no longer try and fix, you know, what America looks like. We would be fixing the hearts of the Americans and turning them to be people of God's kingdom rather than the kingdom that we call America.
Yeah.
Well, so I, you know, yeah, we should expect non-Christians to share our morals? Probably not. Mm-hmm. Probably not healthy. You know, we'd like to teach them more about our morals. Here's the thing. It's like godly people don't replace God, and I think that's where we get screwed up. Is sometimes we want to see, you know, what godly people have done in the past and say, well, that guy loved Jesus. He obviously did the right thing, blah, blah, blah. And maybe it was the right thing when it happened or still the right thing today, but it's still not Jesus, right? So, mm-hmm. like, People who follow Jesus don't replace Jesus. And the same thing is true about a marriage as is true about a society. Is if your entire society is looking towards Christ and Christ alone, you'll all inherently go the same direction because you're following the same ends. And that's the truth, is if you want them to establish the type of morality that you're talking about, A, you have to know the source, and B, you have to agree it is the source to be following, if that's how you want to do it. Otherwise, you're setting up a straw man, and it won't support its own weight. So, anyway, go check that out at ChristianityToday.com. Probably the first time I've looked at that in ever. So, let me know what you think of the site in general. let's see, what else we got? Well, there's a article on Relevant about 6 reasons you seriously need to slow down. And I don't know, this one hit me a little bit closer because, everything does seem to kind of be moving kind of fast, and I, for the life of me, couldn't figure out if any part of it was sinful. It was just the way our society rolls. Everything happens now. Information is now. Actions, reactions are all now. And this dude summed it up. He's got 6 points that I thought we'd roll through real quick and see if we agree or disagree. So here we go. In 1967, experts on time management delivered a report to the U.S. Senate. 1967 now. These experts believed the speed of technology, satellites, and robotics would present a big problem for the American workplace in the years to come. The problem? People would have too much free time. They concluded that by 1985, people might have to choose between working 22 hours a week, 27 weeks a year, or retiring at 38. Good call, experts. If I had a time machine, I would fire all of you. Almost 50 years later, we're moving faster than ever. We're obsessed with being busy and getting things done quickly. Our pace is out of control. If we compare our pace to the pace of Jesus' life, there aren't many similarities. Jesus was never rushed. He wasn't overwhelmed by life, even though he had an enormous mission to complete in a very short period of time. Jesus never rushed because he moved at God's pace. You see, hurry isn't from God. It's the world's pace. Do we agree with that? Hurry is not from God?
Yeah.
I like that. God don't hurry. He does things in God's time. Maybe it might be fast. Maybe not. Here we go. Culture's obsession with busyness and hurriedness isn't just a scheduling problem. It's a heart problem. Dang it. Everybody says it. Everything's a heart problem if you forget it. It's time to consider what a hurried life is costing you. Here we go. Number one, a hurried life destroys your relationship with God. Wing Mandao, a Chinese pastor, said, "We have so much to do that we never really commune with God as he intended in the Garden of Eden."
Wait a minute.
Does he pronounce it? Does he say it that way?
Is his name basically Wing Man?
Wing space Mandao. I said it with the appropriate inflection.
He's a wingman.
Wing Mandao. He basically said, "We have so much to do that we never really commune with God as he intended in the Garden of Eden. Intimacy with God requires stillness, attentiveness, and silence. You must get off life's busy freeway to grow closer to God. Jesus frequently removed himself from the world. He spent time alone in prayer and solitude, and in these moments, Jesus received the strength to fulfill his mission, the confidence to continue his mission, and the wisdom to discern the ways of God from the ways of the world. Unless you spend extended periods of time alone with God through prayer, solitude, and Sabbath, the speed of the world will skew your understanding of God. Anxiety, unrest, and discontentment will hover over your life like a dark storm cloud." How much control does the average man really have over this?
Complete. All you can do is say no.
To say working.
To your schedule. I mean, you choose your schedule.
To say a job.
I mean, your typical person doesn't work. I mean, they work a lot, but I mean...
Usually your boss chooses your schedule.
Well, right, but you're usually not working 100 hours a week. I mean, you might get 40, 50, 60.
Yeah,
that's a lot of free time, though, after
that. Now take that free time and start, and then spend it with your wife and kids.
Yeah, that's what I'm
saying. That sounds
about
the right
control.
Thing to do, though.
And that is not solitude and being alone and communing with God. That is spending time with your wife and kids. Not the same.
Well, you can do both. I mean, you have the choice to schedule your day how you want it to go beyond the boundaries of, your work.
I guess what I'm saying is, like, I understand what he's saying, and I agree with him that it's necessary. It is not the magic picture he's making out to be. This is a very difficult thing to do. There's a lot of, as far as I know, and you could stop me if you disagree, but, like, if a man in our current culture is trying to do the right thing by his wife, his kids, his employer, and his community, there is not that many free hours in the day at all.
You got to use it wisely.
I think you're counting it in the minutes before you're counting it in the hours.
True.
Dan agrees. Booba. Boova ponders.
I'm pondering, yes.
One eyebrow betrays the other. I've got an idea.
So yes, I would agree with that. You have your responsibilities you have to get done. You have to have your responsibilities with God. You've got your responsibilities with wife and or husband and kids and all the good stuff, then your church, the community. But I think that we still are able to spend that time in solitude. Now, you're right. I'm not saying you're able to spend 10 hours a week doing that every single week. However, you know, are you really doing a bad thing by telling your wife and your kids that, hey, you know, we're going to spend the next hour talking to God, but we're going to do it alone, not in community as a family? We've done that. We've been doing that. We had dinner earlier, blah, 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 but we're going to spend, you know, hey, wifey, love you. I'm going to spend an hour with God. You should do the same thing, but we're going to do it alone, not together at the same time. Now, I'm not saying that happens every night. I'm not saying that happens once a week. I'm just saying it can happen.
It can happen.
You choose that.
Here's the thing. I think I know one or two people that I think actually do this and do it well.
That's fair.
I mean, and their life reflects it. That's fair. I can't impress enough that I agree with what this man's saying.
Yeah.
But with the amount of people that I know to do it, it's almost mythical. The amount of people that I think actually do this and do it well, remove themselves from situations, spend time, commune with God. Like for most folks I know, and this includes me, a 10-minute prayer is excruciatingly long. It's just by 10 minutes in, I'm like, I feel like I'm starting to fall asleep. Now I'm starting to disrespect God in the way that how long this prayer has gone on. And like, it's an obvious lack of vibrancy in my prayer life. I get that. And I recognize that to be true. And I think actually this would help change that immensely and would turn that around to be something very different than what it is today. But it's much harder than I think that he's laying it out to be. It's harder to do. I'm not saying it's not worth it. And I'm not saying it doesn't need to be done. I'm just saying it's not as simple as the guys that I know. I'm not asking them to put down Xbox Live. You know what I'm saying? You're looking at saying no to some other things that categorically you would say a good Christian man would do these things.
Right.
These are things that you also need to say no to, not just, hey, he plays video games all night or he's out playing foosball in his garage by himself. This is not the caliber of dude we're talking about. We're talking about actually saying no to overtime at work sometimes and saying, putting the kids to bed and not feeling guilty by saying, I need to go spend some time with God. I am your spiritual leader in this house. I am helping to raise you to know Christ, and I will do that by example, not just by what's coming out of my mouth. So I'm just saying, like, you know,
that's
I think that's a little heavier than what he's saying, although I agree it's pretty important. Number two, Dave Herrick, you have anything to say about that?
I was just thinking, I feel like in a lot of ways, I pursue at least. I don't know if I'm exactly successful on it, but I definitely carve out time and spend probably hours with God throughout the week, if not at least an hour a day or so. I still experience anxiety and fear and things like that. It's not like this is a magic bullet type of a scenario. And
sure,
I might just be a weird exception to things going on, but I don't think it's exactly a cure-all type of thing either. I mean, I'm still experiencing struggles of life and whatnot, but I guarantee it's a lot better with God than without him.
No, it's probably a given.
It's true.
Number two, a hurried life decreases your capacity to love others. It's not a coincidence that the great love passage, 1 Corinthians 13, begins with, love is patient. Love isn't easily angered. Love doesn't leave at the first sign of trouble. It doesn't rush to judgment. In The Rhythm of Life, Matthew Kelly says relationships can only thrive under carefree timelessness. And this is something hurried people don't have. The more you increase the speed of your life, the less capacity you have to love others. Considering the two greatest commandments are to love God and love others, you need to consider whether your hurried life is costing you more than you realize. Yeah, once again, I understand what he's saying. But maybe it's just for me. I feel like I have a... If I can find something that I'm always consistently disappointed with in myself, it's how I've managed my time. I always feel like whatever I thought was the best idea at X time always turns out to have been a mistake. There was always somewhere else I probably should have gone, and I never choose the right place to be. Like, time management is just about something that just makes me feel terrible just about every day. Like, I've spent the wrong, even when I'm at work and I know I have to be there. I don't want to be there. I want to be somewhere else. And it's not because I hate work or I don't need money. I need both those things, right? But, like, In the grand sweep of things, if I could have just gone down to visit my friends who are in the hospital, that's what I'd rather have done. You can keep your money. You know, that obviously doesn't pay for a house for my kids to live in, but you know what I'm saying? Like, I always look at what I'm doing and think I'd rather have been doing something else. And maybe that's just an opportunistic way of life, but like, I don't understand like this characteristic rush lifestyle that he's talking about. Like, is it from sporting events, baseball games, PTA meetings, a bunch of auxiliary groups that maybe you don't belong in, youth group to LTG to, you know, some other whatever self-empowerment group that you are masking through your church? I mean, what is he trying to say is exactly going on? That's the rush.
It sounds like the guy is trying to categorize the people that don't understand their tasks very well. I think that Mike, you've done a good job of painting yourself in a picture of someone who does at least grasp the tasks that they have, which is, you know, God first, your family second, your wife and your family second, and then community, you know, third, whether that be, you know, your church community or community in general, like actually as a citizen. The person that does not understand those roles in life very well could very easily find themselves much more hurried than I think that you're seeing. It could be someone that's constantly caught up in extracurricular activities for the kids and then stuff that they're involved in, whether that's a bowling league that they're in or whatever. I mean,
I do like a good bowling league.
Yeah, who doesn't?
That's where I fellowship.
The specifics aren't the big thing that's important. It's the fact that someone that doesn't spend their time figuring out those four roles in their life. And if they don't know that, I can see that as being a huge problem when it comes to fostering relationships. You've made it a point to foster the relationships you need with your family and with your kids and with your wife and stuff like that. Those are pretty much your most important relationships. And I think that the person that doesn't understand that could very easily lose out on those relationships because they're too hurried. But you've carved time out for that. So maybe that's why you're not seeing that as big of an issue.
Here we go. Number three, a hurried life increases the power of temptation. Through temptation, Satan tries to decrease the time between impulse and action. And in our instant gratification culture, Satan has masterfully deceived people. So many of my mistakes, sex before marriage, stealing, drunkenness, porn addiction, are the result of looking for instant gratification. When you nurture patience and learn to wait, you trust God to give you the things in time that Satan says you need now.
I would agree with that.
Yeah, I'm 100% with him on that.
Yep.
I think I'm on the opposite end.
No!
What?
Okay.
I'd say an idle life leaves more room for temptation because you're laying around with nothing else to do. If you're busy, you don't have time to what you're really really busy. Whoops, had premarital sex. I mean, what? I mean,
oh no.
How did that happen?
We need to make a plush doll where you pull that and Dan says that. Oh, whoops, no. I've had premarital sex.
I mean, I understand he's talking more about setting up the instant gratification thing, but whatever your schedule, like, we're still in that instant gratification society.
Yeah, so maybe
it's
this
when
doesn't
you're
tie
idle
directly
that you have,
with hurriedness.
Your mind starts wandering, and you think, well, I got nothing else to do. I'll go beat the neighbor or something.
I mean, guy's trying to make the point that hurriedness is the enemy of patience. And therefore, if you lack patience, therefore, you're willing to give an instant gratification, which I think is a weird line to draw.
Yeah, you know, actually, I think this is this is telltale of maybe our instant gratification society. But people have no patience for uncomfortableness. Or any type of itch that, like, I mean, they just got to scratch it. They can't let it sit for, 10 seconds. Anyway, I mean, I can watch the same behavior in my 8-year-old and 5-year-old daughters. I can watch in grown men. I'm hungry right now. I want to have sex right now. I will do it with anybody that is available. Now. I need money now. I will do what I need to do to get it right now. Like, no patience, no best way, no best practices, no morality that is supposed to be rampant throughout our agreed society. Just now. Let me do this thing now. And, yeah, guilty as charged. Me too. I do this exact same thing. But, like, it's almost embarrassing. You know what I'm saying? Like, there's some dudes that used to be able to take some pain now. We can't take any pain. Ouch. I'm going to the doctor right now. I just can't take this anymore. Same guy that, you know, 75 years ago walked around like that for 10 years. And the worst you heard about him was a grunt when he got out of a chair.
There's a nail sticking out of your head.
Yeah.
Whatever.
Happened to my granddad, too. Yeah, I agree with him on, I don't know, broad point maybe. The instant gratification thing, I think Dan's right. I think that comes with laziness or hurriedness or regular living. That's just kind of our deal.
Just existing in the world.
Number four, hurried life numbs you to injustices. This one I find very true. As Kirk Jones, who I have no idea who that is, said, hurry is a desensitizer, snuffing out moments of intimacy with life to the point that we get used to living day after day with little deep feeling. When your life moves at freeway speed, you have no time or energy to consider the world outside of your lane. You become desensitized or unaware of brokenness in the world. Your heart becomes callous to the things that break God's heart. The Syrian refugee crisis, the abortion of millions around the world, the heinous treatment of God's people by ISIS. God's heart breaks for injustice and oppression. If your heart doesn't break for the things that break God's heart, it's time to slow down and consider the world outside of your life.
I think there's a sense of self-importance that kind of comes along with the hurriedness that contributes to this one. I'm not sure hurriedness alone will do that, but yeah, the self-importance that usually goes with it, very much so.
Now, see, I can grasp what he's saying here, but I have a hard time putting that in practical terms because I feel like if you got on top of the things that breaks God's heart, if you know, and spent time on all the things that breaks God's heart, you would literally never do anything in your lane. You would spend all your time doing that. That's why he's God. He can handle those things. You know what I'm saying? I'm not saying to be calloused around everything that involves with you, but I feel like that's more of a prayer figure out where God's got me, you know, where my heart, where he's ingrained my heart to be, opposed to jumping on every sad sack story that comes flying by you. You just can't, you know, you'll never do anything that way.
I think that that I would agree with that with with trying to spend all of your time figuring out God-sized issues. You're not able to see you-size issues that you can fix. You know, if your heart is constantly breaking over homelessness in the entire world, and all you're trying to do is feed everybody in the world, and you're trying to do that and spend so much time on that, did you just pass the guy that's on the side of the road that you could have gone and helped? That one dude. Yeah, that's not a God-sized thing in the spectrum of, like, it being huge, but that one person's life that you could have affected that is in your lane, were you so worried about the kind of huge things that God needs to affect that you miss the things that God has you there to fix?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I feel like Jesus is probably the example on this thing, right? Like, there's people he did not heal. There's
right.
people that he did.
Yep.
All were at the direction of the Father. And, like, that's an easy cop-out, right? And we will use it just as that. And if you are using it as that, then you are sinful. You are purposely not doing anything. And I'm not exactly sure why, but like, if you are earnestly praying on, God, give me your heart for whatever it is that you've implanted in mine, I think you can't go wrong with that. And I feel like if you are not doing anything, then you're not listening.
That probably completes the circle of what he's saying, though, because we're so busy, we're not praying, so we don't have the heart of God, so we're ignoring the mission of God. It's kind of the whole package.
Yeah, I think I probably agree with that.
And there are times I'm definitely guilty.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's almost the hypocrisy that I'm capable of is blows me away sometimes, right? Because these are the exact same things I will say to you know, people who I'm talking to about Jesus, like new, you know, Christians who just got to know who Christ is, and like some of the folks in our youth group and stuff. I'm like, listen, if you want to know who God is, you have to have a prayer life. You have to know who you're dealing with. You have to talk to him and allow him to speak back to you, and you can get a broad character from the Bible and examples of who his people are and how they interact with him. But if you want to know him, you do that through prayer and through people around you that have that relationship that you can learn about with him with. And I will say these things all day long, and I will be just as guilty of not doing them as anyone else I know. You know, I will make no bold statements or changes to get that straightened out. And it, like the downfall of most people's relationship with God is always prayer, because it takes up time and silences. Is a blaring horn in most people's lives. They would rather be irritated by train whistles and stopped at a stoplight than have to deal with any amount of silence and allowing God to speak through it. It's just it's grating. Here we go. Number five. Well, what do we got? Two more here? Number five. Here we go. Number five. A hurried life increases narrow-mindedness and legalism. I don't really care about that one. Number six. A hurried life clouds your purpose and diminishes your passion. Purpose is a trendy word in today's culture. I don't think so. I feel like purpose has been around a long time, and I feel like it's not. Maybe it has a different social group of people, but it's not a buzzword where I hang out. Purpose is a trendy word in today's culture. It's also more elusive than the Loch Ness Monster. Really, really getting on all cylinders. In a hurried culture, your life's purpose is determined by what you do. It's all about what you can see, what you can hold. But God's idea of purpose isn't about doing, it's about becoming. Ooh, up in the clouds we go. You can do good things for God, but if those good things don't flow from a relationship with God, discovering your purpose will feel a lot like looking for a two-legged unicorn. So, think about these questions. Are love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, faithfulness, gentleness, and self-control increasing in your heart? Are you a man or woman of integrity? Are you trustworthy? Do the people who know you most respect you? A hurried life looks externally for answers to life's big questions, but a life at God's pace looks internally for these answers. Your life's pace matters. Unless you move at God's speed, you won't see the world through God's lens. Sum up sentence, I don't believe God is impressed with an exhaustion. He isn't glorified when you take on so many responsibilities that your soul floods with unrest and discontentment. Feeling burnt out isn't a badge of faithfulness. Take your foot off the gas and slow down. Overall, what do you think? Fairly solid?
Yeah, I agree with most of it. Yeah,
we really agree with the major principle of you need to throttle back your life a little bit and the pace of which you're doing things. I don't know independently if each one of the six runs its own car. I think they're carpooling. If everybody's together in a minivan, these six things make good sense to me. But driving their own Volvo apiece, I don't know if they hold their own water. You've been listening to Live from the Path on livefromthepath.org, broadcasting every Monday night from 10 to whatever's. We got a little bit more show to go. I think we do have a little bit of Pope style advice that I thought we were going to hear from. Boova, did you have some Pope style?
I did, yes.
You better throw down on it.
All right, here's the deal. So with Pope style advice, if you didn't realize, so what's happened is a couple of my buddies have decided to start messing with me and have gone around to the local crawls and have started telling people that I'm the Pope. And what's happened is there's a group of people that have shown up in front of my house. Yes, Mike?
Is the Pope an evangelical?
No.
Got it. I'm trying to figure out what's going
on. A bunch of people are outside of my house and are now refusing to leave unless I come out and give some kind of papal wisdom from the Pope-mobile. So my Pope-style advice is, if you can't remember the last time you gave something up for God or really gave something to God, you might want to take a step back and take a look at that. Now, I'm not saying something just physical, and I'm not saying you have to give something up as in like, hey, I gave up pop recently for God. I'm not saying that's the only thing, but if you completely have a relationship with God that is nothing but take, I think it's time to take a step back, because I think we very easily get involved in that shallow of a relationship with God, where it's God exists as this eternal and universal gift giver, and he exists to hand me things that I'm looking for, and he exists to give me things to bless me in my life. And if your relationship is solely based on that kind of dynamic, you are missing out on so much of what God is and so much of what God exists to be. He's not just some genie in the sky that wants to grant what you want. He exists to have an open relationship with you, and that alone as a statement is incredible. The perfect being that created everything in the world has decided that he loves you enough and knows every one of your flaws, but still wants to have a relationship with you. There's people here in the world that I don't like because they said something to me once and I want nothing to do with them. Yet God knows everything about me and still wants a full relationship with me in honesty and in communication and in gift giving and back and forth. Very recently, I ran into a situation where I had to stop and look at that. Of in the last 3 months, 6 months, year, what have I honestly given to God? What have I given back to his people? What have I given in devotion and in trust with God? And I couldn't answer that question. I didn't know. I was very comfortable in a place where I had not recently done anything that made me step out from where I was and honestly give something to and give something up for God. And it's something small for me, and it's something that I'm planning on doing. I realized that one of my idols is food, and one of the things that I love and run to is food. And I realized that I've never trusted God enough to completely give that up. I've done a day fast. I've done a couple days where I didn't
eat. Are you completely giving up food, Bubba?
No, no. What I'm saying is that's my idol. So I can't give up food entirely, obviously. I mean, I if God wanted me to and he told me to, I'd do it. But I'm not feeling that from God right now.
I think I'd pray on that. Are you sure about this?
Exactly. God, are you certain you want me to just go that 40-day fasting?
You mean all food?
You want me to, like, everything? No, I recently realized that I hadn't given anything to God, and I started praying on, you know, what's constantly in my mind. What's that one thing that I'm saying I couldn't do? What's the one thing that keeps popping in my head that I could not do? And it kept popping up in my head. Dude, there's no way that you'd be able to give up meat for God. You couldn't do it. You couldn't do it if you had to. And I started thinking to myself, you're right. I couldn't do it, but God can. He's the one that can completely sustain me through that situation. And that may be something that doesn't mean a lot to anybody else, and that's fine. And no offense to you, I'm not doing it for you. I'm doing it for me and God. But that was the thing that kept popping up in my head. And that's what I'm doing. I'm giving up meat for however long. Like, I think I'm just going to keep going until I feel like it's no longer an issue. I originally set a date on it, but I decided maybe that's me trying to run God things. And I don't want to do that. So I'm going to let God be the one who tells me when I'm done. And if that's in a day, that's in a day. And if that's in a week, that's a week. If that's a year or the rest of my life, that's God telling me, hey, buddy, this is when you're to stop. And that's the specific situation that I'm in. But I want you to step back and think to yourself, what is the last thing you really did and you gave up or gave to God? And if you can't answer that question, maybe it's time to ask him what he wants. Maybe it's time to ask him what he wants you to give up. And that's a hard conversation for some people to have. And it's not an easy thing to just walk into and say, hey, God, good morning. What am I giving up today? You really need to come to a place where you are humbling yourself to the fact that God is the one that sustains you and controls you. He is the one that should provide for you. And if you think you're providing for yourself, maybe you need to give something up for God. And maybe you need to reconvene with him as your creator and as the God of this universe and the one who ordained your life. He's the one that completely set you in motion, and maybe it's time to get back to that.
Well, that's really kind of amazing. I mean, I feel like I was just having a conversation earlier today with my wife about how our prayer lives just often seem so just very flat, in that we're constantly asking God for things and thanking him for things, and that's pretty much about 90% of what we communicate to God. And it became kind of evident to me today when I was hearing my daughter praying, and that's kind of what she communicates to God as well, is the same dynamic of, you know, hey God, please give us this, and God, thank you for this, and it just kind of reinforces this type of relationship where we just, I mean, yeah, it's good we're dependent on God as our Father, but is that the sum total of our relationship? Is he gives us things and we just say, hey, thanks God, can you give me something else? And it's like that. It's such a small part of what a relationship could be. And I don't know. Recently, God's really been just rocking my prayer life and just expanding on some of these things. And so, if you guys got a few minutes, I'll go through some of that too. Unless
actually, I think I'm pretty excited to hear about that. We're probably gonna have to hit it right after the break.
Okay,
that's cool. You've been listening to Life from the Path on LifeFromThePath.org. Look, thanks for joining us. If you're on the KTI IA broadcast, we're gonna have to let you go. We got a ton more stuff coming up on the podcast. Especially, I'm pretty jazzed up to hear about Dave's prayer life shakings. So hang out for that. I don't know. Ben says a bunch of stuff at the end of the program, and I ain't got it. So thanks for listening. Be faithful in the means. God will handle the ends. We'll see you on the podcast. You're listening to Life from the Path.
Leave a light on for me. I don't know if you remember that we've gone by each other.
Solid.
A time or two before.
Solid.
Leave a light podcast on for me.
The podcast ramps up again. Okay, well. here's the deal. If that's the worst thing that happens when Ben's not here, you know, that's a win. Hey,
yeah.
Things usually
we'll call that
go,
success.
Yeah, they completely derail and catch on fire. And so far, you know, we got every batter in the lineup hitting and getting on base. So no problems. So, Dave Herrick, God's been shaking up your prayer life. You want to tell me more about that?
Yeah, I mean, I talked about it a little bit last week, but just the short version is, you know, I've been just going through a lot of strange anxieties and things, especially at night when I'm alone. And I'll just go to God with prayer and just talking with him. And you know, I've been trying out a lot of different things, including finding rest in him, and that's been amazing. And just kind of focusing on today and not be thinking about tomorrow and being worried about tomorrow, which kind of is reminiscent of what Jesus told me to do to begin with. So maybe I should just be listening to him.
Right.
Can you
unpack when you say resting in him?
Resting
let's
in
pretend
him.
Pretend someone listening to the
oh
podcast
yeah
has no
I forgot
idea what
you weren't
that means
here last week. Okay. So, quick review. I've discovered recently that at the end of my day, my normal routine is think about responsibilities that I've left to do. Just kind of what are the last details on my to-do list? Things for the day, things maybe that I need to take care of for tomorrow. Did I mail whatever envelope? Something like that. I'll just go through this mental checklist, make sure that I've got a plan for whatever responsibilities are still outstanding. And that's typically been the way that I'll end a day and then find rest after that. And recently that has not been working out so well, and God's actually been eliminating that from me, which is strange because coming up with pretty good plans has been one of my strengths. And so God's removed that from me and said, no, instead, you're simply going to trust in me. Those are the things that you want to plan on. You've got time tomorrow to plan on those. You're not going to plan those things out before you go to sleep tonight. You're going to rest. And so I've been trying to work through this dynamic of switching from finding rest essentially in my plans and saying, hey, I've got a plan for these things. I've got a way of resolving things and checking my plans. Instead, now I'm checking with God at the end of the day for permission to rest and just say, hey, have I accomplished what I need to do today? Have I done the work that you need for me to do today, God? And can I take my rest? And so instead of checking with my own agenda and checking with my own plans, it's checking with God and saying, now can I rest? And it very much correlates the beginning of my day where I start off and say, hey, God, what do you have for me today? What would you like me to accomplish? And so at the beginning of the day, I'll start asking God, what do you want me to accomplish? At the end of the day, I'll ask him, you know, I want to go to bed. I want to tuck up the day. Otherwise, the to-do list is never ending. Can I take my rest now? And, you know, so sometimes he'll surprise me. Like, I mean, one day I asked him, hey, you know, I've got work later on tonight. Can I go to work? And he said, no. And it threw me off. I'm like, wait a minute. So do I need to call in and say, hey, I'm not coming? Or how do I resolve this? And eventually I kind of asked God, okay, can I go to play? You know, same location, meet with the same folks. But can I go to play? And he's like, yeah, you can go play. And it's like, okay. So I went to the same place, did kind of more or less the same type of activities, but played and made sure that I didn't cross the line between the enjoyment and the joy of play and what might be considered work. And God was all right with that. And so he's been kind of setting up my day, and he's also been helping me to tuck in at night. One of the things recently, though, that's changed is as I've been calling out to him, especially when in the middle of anxiety, and you know, recently I've been able to find just about anything to be afraid of, and that's very uncharacteristic of me, but just it's the time that I'm going through, and so I'll be calling out to him, hey, you know, with whatever my fear is, and it's like, God, can you take this away? Help me to trust you, because I know that ultimately that's the issue that's going on, is that. And I've found it's happened frequently enough that I find that the resolution finally happens when I take my eyes off myself and take my eyes onto him. It's when, to put it this way, it's when I stop asking for myself and I start just looking at him and talking to God about him. And saying, look, God, I know you're bigger than this. I know you can handle this. And it's like almost immediately peace comes right then, just realizing that, you know what, he's big enough. He can handle these things. He loves us. He loves me. And I can trust him with what's going on. And it's when I start looking at him and who he is and his character and what he's got going on, that's when the peace comes. It's not in me going to God and requesting, hey, God, please give me peace. It's when I actually look to him and essentially his character and who he is kind of enters my mind and occupies that space that normally would be occupied by fear. And I guess whatever, if it's spiritual and, you know, there's some kind of crazy fear demon going on, apparently he's really uncomfortable being in the same head when the head is occupied with how awesome God is, and he just splits. And so then I'm just left with peace, and immediately joy always follows. Whenever God gives me peace, it's like just, I can't help but just laugh and enjoy life. So if I want to summarize it, what's changed just in this last week is not praying so much for myself and, hey, God, please take this away, as much as just fixing my eyes on God. And just, I will talk to God about him. I mean, some of you guys have been on dates. You know that girls like to hear good things about themselves. Well, guess what? So does God.
You're going to have to tell Boova more about this.
Okay. He's not familiar. Yeah, what is what's a date?
What is a lady?
So you're out with another person, and you know, you want to talk about them. You don't want to just talk about yourself all the time. That's rude.
Oh, that explains a lot.
All right, so apparently that has now seeped into my prayer life. And so it's strange, because I'll talk to God and I'll say, God, you are just plain awesome. And, you know, God loves to hear that. And it's also great for me to hear myself saying these things, because it reminds me that, hey, guess what? God is, in fact, awesome. And I can rest in his awesomeness.
So wait a minute. So what you're telling me is the ladies don't like me talking about how great I am and giving them reasons to date me? And God also doesn't like me sitting there talking about how great I am in my prayer life with him?
Apparently no one does.
Oh, man.
Sorry, Boova.
Boy, tough role today, Boova.
I got to change some personality flaws, guys.
Actually, this kind of helps reorient some of the thing that I think I struggle with a lot when I pray is I know how to handle a two-person conversation, because I can always deflect to, what's going on with you? Mm-hmm. How are you feeling? What do you think of this situation, other person? Even if I don't have anything else to say, I can, and I don't have to say anything about myself. I can just keep asking you questions and say, how are things with you? Yeah. You know, conversation continues on. Mm-hmm. Now, with God, I always got to, you know, kind of a stalemate, where I would say, hey, God, I suppose they're probably pretty good, I guess. Okay, about me then. you know what I'm saying?
Why not just talk to God about things that you appreciate about him and just go from there? I mean, make up a list. It might sound a little cheesy. It might sound a little like a love letter, but guess what? That's kind of a cool thing to have in your prayer.
And maybe it'd be a good idea to stop trying to be the voice of God in your own prayers.
Well, here's the deal. I like to imagine what God would respond to the things that I say.
Let him respond.
Like I say, Lord, here's what I'm thinking about. Maybe I was going to get involved with tomorrow. And I hear a voice that says, sounds good, Mike. Thank you.
Hey, I'm willing to bet that some weird posturing dude that says something like, sounds good, Mike, is probably your head, not God.
Like a Hallmark Santa.
Oh, good one, Mike. Glad I made that sense of humor.
Help the homeless every day. Did you ask me first? Careful of Jesus Santa. Can't be trusted. Jesus only, not Jesus Santa. Yeah, I have a hard time orienting my prayers in that way. And like we've talked about this on the show before, like sometimes I think I have a hard time orienting my prayers because I don't know how to deal with the king correctly. Someone who's in authority that really appreciates and loves me fully, but is not dependent on that being the case in reciprocation for him to love me. You know what I'm saying? He will do it regardless because he's a good king. But like, I don't know how to handle someone like that. I've never met anyone like that. I've never met another human being that will love me regardless of how I treat them. And like, that's hard to look in the face. You know what I'm saying? It's hard to look in the eye and go, You honestly love me no matter how many times I ignore you or say that I think my way is better than yours or neglect the love that you've given me, and you still show up with eyes that say, I love you anyway. And like, I don't know how to take you, to be honest with you. I don't know how to deal with you on a regular front. And so that's why we use prayer, right? Because if he can be dealt with in a way other than prayer, we would do that. But he can't be, because he's just different. He's a good sovereign king, and you can't talk to him the way that you talk to the guy who runs the deli. It's not the same conversation. So anyway, take that. All right, let's do some thanks, Dave. I appreciate that. I think that does help reorient just a little bit. Anybody have, you know, does anyone else struggle with that? Like how to approach God in prayer and either not sound like a phony baloney or come off as like, You feel like you're talking into a tin can of where you feel like I'm not really connecting with God. I am just speaking in a dark room like a jack wagon.
You ever had that friend that that never thinks they should be your friend? Like they're always willing to beat themselves down and make it seem like you shouldn't really talk to them. I have some friends like that are just kind of like...
I make everybody feel appreciated, Booba. I don't have this problem.
Well, I've got some self-deprecating friends that like almost every conversation we have a conversation of, hey, man, I don't understand why you're my friend. You're just kind of a good dude and all this different stuff. And I feel like that's kind of sometimes my relationship with God. Like I have difficulty stepping back and realizing God loves every one of us wholeheartedly and isn't some guilt trip God that's trying to make us sit there the first 10 minutes of our prayer talking about how crappy we are and then getting into the nitty gritty of the prayer. I feel like sometimes I spend way too much time in the whole, and I'm not saying don't do it. I'm saying like I spend way too much time in the whole, hey God, well, man, I'm a joke.
That's the thing.
I suck.
You do. You spend the first minute and a half, 2 minutes explaining to God on how much you realize what the situation is. Here's the situation.
It's like,
I am this and you are this.
It's like, hey God, I know you know everything, but did you know about this? Like, I did this recently. I feel like you shouldn't talk to me for a while, but
that's
I don't know. Hey, God, you know I messed that up too, right? Like, I don't know if you were you watching at that
I
point in time?
I want you to know that I know that I understand why you think of me the way that you do. Because I've done things.
And I feel like I waste so much time in my prayer life with this weird self-deprecation where I break myself down rather than building him up.
But it's true.
It's true, but... Like, there's a point that you can reach. Like, I feel like I crossed that point. Like, I understand that it's good to have a healthy humility when talking to God and realizing, yeah, I am the flawed creature in this relationship, and I'm the one who messes up. But, like, to the point where you kind of sometimes miss out on your prayer time because all you've done is sit there and go, hey, God, I really screwed up on this today.
That's right. Sometimes
and he's sitting there with his
home.
Hands in his lap going, yeah, I know, son, let's talk. We've got other stuff to talk about. I know, son, you messed that up, but seriously, Troy,
let's go on.
Let's talk.
let's get on to good things.
Let's talk about some seriously good stuff. Hey, did you notice how you did this great? Or did you notice how someone else around you did something great and you could have watched? Hey, pay attention to that stuff.
Yeah, I think that's sometimes where I buck up against the thought of realizing that we are innately bad and sinful, and I get that, right? But, like, if you're stuck there your whole life, you missed out on such a blessing and to being not only to other people, but for what God wanted to give you. And the possibilities were so huge, and you couldn't get past the fact that you're not him. Right? That was in the first page, man. You opened the Bible, first page one, you are not him. Okay. Like, I realize that's a standing tenet of whatever, and you gotta realize you're depraved and blah, blah, blah. Okay. But once you get there, you really want to focus the next 50 years of your life on that? God doesn't want to. It's a perspective. Once you gain that perspective, it's not a daily thing. I will never lose the perspective of I'm from the Midwest, right? It's ingrained in me. It's not going to change now. And so the same is true about your depravity. Once you realize that, I don't know that you lose it unless you completely walk away from God as a whole and have to re-engineer it back in. But like once you have that perspective, I don't know that you need to be bogging your prayer life down and with the precious time that you get in your hurried lifestyle that you get to dissociate with everything and spend time with God, and you want to spend a good portion of that describing how crappy you are. Duly noted, he had actions that would rectify the situation. He's done them. Let's move on and get moving for what God has us to be doing. I think that's an excellent point, fellas.
I think one of the challenges of prayer, though, is that you read through Scripture and just your relationship with him, you know, there are sometimes he shows up as your buddy. You know, hey, I'm with you, you know, we're brothers. And sometimes he's this sovereign God who, you know, is inapproachable practically. And then there's Paul saying, but we approach the throne with boldness. You know, you have all these different images of God. And he's big enough, he's like all at once, right? But I can only like process or handle one of those at a time.
I agree.
So sometimes I come up, hey, buddy, you know, how you doing, Jesus? Hey. And the next time I'm like, oh, sovereign Lord, you know. I mean, and part of that's my problem, yeah. I guess.
I know I deserved a smite when I walked in. Thank you for that.
Great is thou, holy, holy, holy is the Lord God Almighty. You know, I mean, You got angels who've been with him for centuries that fall before him in his presence, and it's like, really, you're not used to that?
Yeah, and I'm boldly strolling in, be like, yeah. What's up?
Hey, buddy,
I've so, served you in the teen number of years, right. So, opposed to the millennia these other fellows have been here.
Hey, God, did you see what I did yesterday? Yeah,
did you put my picture on the refrigerator?
Hey, Dad, you see that A+ I got?
What do you mean I got moved to the deep freeze? I feel like I did good stuff.
Come move to the deep freeze.
All right, there we go. Ready? Dear Life from the Path. I have been friends with quotations Janet for 8 years. We have been very close, talk often, and go to lunch 3 times a month. We are like 2 peas in a pod and have always been honest with each other. Our relationship is open and above board. On a recent holiday, I went to her house for a party, got drunk, and made an inappropriate comment to one of her friends, who had also had too much to drink. Janet called me out in front of the others, demanded I apologize, told me that what I had said was disrespectful, and said she doesn't want to see me again. Life from the past, she tossed me out an 8-year friendship over one comment. I don't understand. Do you? Stupid guy out west. That's a dude. Janet's friend, the dude. 8 years, pretty above board relationship as far as this guy's concerned. Obviously, probably made a sexual comment, judging by his not including it in the message.
Right.
Yeah, if he would have been like, hey, I don't like your dress, I think he would have included that. But that is not what he said. And it sounds like, if I had to guess, it's at her house, it's a party. He probably said it around a bunch of other ladies, where she had no choice but to call him out as the chauvinist, drunk fool that he was acting.
Well, and she knows that words are the overflow of the heart. So whatever he said, although it was inappropriate, and he normally would have boundaries up to keep himself from doing that, he said it.
Yep.
And it was hurtful.
Yep, the Michelob on tap just went ahead and moved that valve open, where there was nothing restricting what was coming out of his mouth. Boova?
I'm just imagining, like, either she has no idea how to handle confrontation and did this and now never wants to speak to him again, or he's totally downplaying what he said. And she had every right to destroy an 8-year relationship.
Maybe she was doing a little drinky too, and she way overreacted.
Well, in that case, hey, maybe give her a call real quick and say, hey, Janet, obviously I said some stupid stuff, and I'm sorry about that.
8 years, though? 3 times a month lunch?
Right. Like, I'm imagining either she's overreacting like a monster, you are underreacting to what you said, you jerk.
Or there's just plain strain in the relationship, and that was like the last straw.
I bet there's some romantic stuff that hasn't been addressed between the two of them, and she got jealous.
3 times a month for 8 years.
And he said a raunchy comment to some other lady.
Yep.
I'm willing to think that, it's a possibility where she got a little jealous.
Here's the deal, out west, man. You're leaving out details that would be very helpful for us to make a solid determination here.
Yeah, we don't know what's up until you tell us the truth. That's out west.
Either way, I think you need to go talk to Janet and just apologize and seriously fix it. Just even ask her, hey, what do I need to do to put this right?
Yeah.
But, you know, it's an 8-year relationship. Why, you know, don't let it go. Fight for it.
Secular says, not knowing what you said, I can only guess it was so far off the charts that you offended not only the person to whom the comment was directed, but also Janet and the other guests at the party. What did this guy say?
He said something bad.
Man, I mean, that just have to be outrageous.
There's some raunch-tastic stuff that happened at that party.
She may have reacted the way she did because you have done similar things in the past. That's a reach. Yeah. You'll have a clear understanding if you talk to her about it when you call to apologize. Yeah. Basically, same advice. Look, you have to call up to Janet. Here's the deal. I said bad stuff. I was a fool.
Mm-hmm. And I'm still a fool. Except me.
Yeah.
Well, I like what Herrick said. You know, it's worth fighting for. I mean, that's a strong word, but it's true. Yeah. It's like an 8-year relationship. Go after it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, 3 times a month, this is not a casual.
Right. You're trying to get married.
An 8-year relationship. An 8-year relationship does not come without some sacrifices and some serious effort.
You know, maybe
keep it going.
Maybe she's in a relationship with another fella, and he's like, look, I don't like this dude. I don't know why you're going out to lunch with him 3 times in a month.
Hey, man, that might be a stretch, too.
Is it? Okay. Dear Life from the Path. I disagree with Boova. I feel like I was right there. Dear Life from the Path. What can I do about my boss? I have worked at a bus company for 23 years. My new boss started 6 months ago. He jokes and laughs with all the other ladies in the office, but when it comes to me, he's all business. He talks to me only about things that are work-related, and when I try to talk to him about anything else, he gives me a forced grin and walks away. Any suggestions? Wow. Here's the deal.
Please submit a picture.
Yeah. I mean,
I feel like if I am going to be open and outgoing with a bunch of people, and then there's one person that I just force a grin and walk away from, there is a real reason why I do that. Like, there's a legitimate, it's not just, oh, I don't like that scarf, Janice, yeah, and then walk away. Like, there's a legit thing that he does not in any way like about you.
Yeah, I mean,
if you're willing,
it could be a million things.
Yeah, if you're willing to really push this and have that relationship with your boss, you can ask him.
Yeah.
Be like, hey, boss man, I noticed, like, I've seen some stuff around the office where everybody else, you kind of have a joking relationship with me. It feels like we kind of have some strain between us. If you're willing to go that far and figure it out. If not, he's your boss. Leave it alone. Do your job. Go home to your actual friends and live your life.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, you could have the personality of a saltine. You could be known as a whistleblower.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? There's a million things that you could have done. That and really, you've left out any personal culpability here. Like, I've heard this exact argument with people that I've worked with and around.
Yep.
And they completely leave out the part where they, you know, ratted out the last guy they worked with. Or got the last manager fired because they didn't like how many paper clips he had on the desk and thought he was over abusing the HR department.
Donald, you're the one who gives me the creepy eye every time. You never make that statement. Like, yeah, there's some weird going on between the two of you that you're not willing to talk about.
Yeah. Like, and the fact that you've taken the time to write this down and ask somebody about it means you've tried to talk to someone else in your office. Like, don't you feel like he stands around talking to everyone else and laughing and having a good time? Well, does that sound like someone that I can hang around with and be openly friendly with in a workplace environment when you seem to be stickler for the rules and don't permit a whole bunch of office fare? I don't know, man. I feel like you've played some culpability in here and not really owning up to it.
There's something she's leaving out.
You're the only one. There's obviously a reason. And you're usually the last person to know.
Maybe you wear ugly sweaters and he just cannot find any common ground with you.
Maybe his family has some weird family vendetta against your family.
Yeah. Maybe you are the Hatfields. And he is indeed the McCoys.
It's a possibility.
Secular says, your new boss may be intimidated because of your seniority and experience. That's a nice way of saying you're a jerk.
Yeah.
It may also be because of your age. Absolutely.
That could be.
I am unsure of his reason for treating you differently, but your next move should be to have a talk with your boss to express your feelings about this. I disagree with that. Here's the deal. If obviously, the person's older, has been working there 23 years, right?
Yeah.
You know, it might be time to just cash this thing in. So, look, give me, work out your days at this place. I mean, I don't know. Do you really have to have it all? Yeah. You had a job that was good enough when you got it. Now you want a job and an active social life at that job. You know, now you're just grasping for everything. Give me the whole bucket of oysters, friend.
Yeah, you have to be willing to have the conversation of, hey, boss man, there's something weird going on between us. And you have to be able to handle the brunt of the consequences from that, good or bad. Or you just decide, well, it's a job. Been here for 23 years. Don't give a crap about this young whippersnapper who's only been here for 6 months. I'm just going to keep doing my job and get my paycheck.
Yeah, I can like this man. He don't have to like me.
Yeah.
That's fine.
Yep.
Love it.
That's fair.
Here we go. Got time for one more. Here we go. No, this is
when you say here we go, that's normally when you would follow with Dear Life from the Path.
Yeah, but someone has offered up their suggestions on how to do Thanksgiving better, and I don't really care about that.
No, we need to move to a different one.
That does sound. Here we go. Dear Life from the Path, my 25-year-old sister, quotes Laura, who has four children with her deadbeat, quotes, boyfriend, lives at my 57-year-old mother's house and cheats on him. Mom is suspicious. Indeed. Because Laura sometimes doesn't come home from work, and she's always using the excuse that she's, quotes again, going to a friend's house. Classic lies. This leaves my mother babysitting Laura's children. Should I keep out of it while watching my nieces and nephews suffer? I don't know what to tell Mom when she calls me to vent. As Laura's brother, should I say something to get the message across?
Yes.
Yeah.
Your siblings.
Who are you helping, dude?
Seriously, have a friggin' conversation with your sister. How difficult is that? Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're different genders. I get that's maybe a little weird. But at the same point in time, have a conversation with her. Say, hey, Laura, you know how you cheat on your boyfriend and how Mom sometimes gets weirded out by that? Hey, maybe you can fix that and not be a shyster.
Yeah, I'm not really sure what you're protecting. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. He doesn't have a stake to be like, not have this conversation with his sister yet.
And here's the
deal. Sounds like dude's just kind of a pansy and won't have it.
I know some moms. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Moms are not these naive creatures that you're painting her out to be. She knows exactly what the heck's going on.
Yes, exactly.
Right? I mean, she's not a fool. She knows exactly what's happening. So it's not like she's waiting on your revelation to straighten this up. She knows what the deal is. She doesn't know what to do. Yeah. She doesn't know what to do about the deal. Because, I mean, really, you have to own up to some pretty ugly realities, which is that you're the daughter that you raised, seems to not give two craps about her kids, does whatever she wants, seems to not have much integrity for the relationship she's in, and you're hanging around with her would-be parentheses boyfriend who's living at your place. The mom's in a very weird spot, and I think she just doesn't know what to do. And go ahead, Dan.
I would say I have talked to people in this exact position before, and generally they get it. They know. Like you say, they know, okay, my daughter, something's just not right, you know, whatever. That's beside the point. Their biggest concern is the grandkids now.
Yes.
It's like, and there's no easy answer there. What do? You kick them out and say, I can't support you anymore. You're on your own. Well, we already know how much she cares about her kids. So what does that mean? Where's she going to leave the kids now? Where are the kids going to be? Just laying around at home? I mean, that is a tough situation. I don't have an answer because there's too many nuances to you know, too many things to know. But she's being taken advantage of. They need to fix that somehow. That's above my pay grade.
It's going to be awkward, but you need to man up and have a conversation with your sister.
Oh, yeah. You think that's going to help?
It won't help. It's just, blow up.
If you can look at your kids in the eye, you think you give you care what your brother has to say?
No. However, we're not. That's not the problem right now. The problem is this guy is holding this in and is trying to find some way to shirk it off to somebody else because he knows exactly what's going on. It's bothering him. He knows it's bothering the rest of his, like his mom. But right now, so far, he is not willing to go as far as to have a conversation.
Yeah. That's true. He's probably the most stable element in the family at this point. Because, you know,
mom feels weird. Sister is compromised. He's the only one who can have this conversation right now.
But it still won't fix it. I mean, it's going to blow up, and that's good. They need to have it. I think you should have it. Mm-hmm. But I mean, you're talking about a mother who is, let's just say it, abusing her children and doesn't care.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, she's beyond. And then what do? You call DHS? Well, then they take the kids away. Where do they go then? Who knows? Not to you. They used to go somewhere else.
Right.
Even though your grandma or uncle, whatever. It is a no-win situation.
Yeah, but I think we can all agree on the next step. Is him having a conversation with
us. I just wish we could fix it. I want to fix it. You can't fix stupid sometimes. Mm-hmm.
Truth.
Here's the deal. I think I kind of agree with you in principle, but like I just don't have the same love for this man to need to get this off his chest. Like he's not the guy that's fighting in the weeds there. He's standing on the third party. He's like, this is hard to watch. And I'm like, okay, dude, you know, like you're barely affected by this. Like if you're going to be in there to affect some kind of change or that you want to be part of the solution, that's one thing. But just because you want to vent, because it's eating you up. You're like, I mean, you're out in the peripherals, man. Like, I don't have the same sympathy for this dude, I think.
Yeah, but, I mean, you look at it one of two ways. He has two ultimate choices. He can either back out and then not do anything, stop caring, or he needs to get in and start doing something.
Well, so he's not caring about his nieces or,
If he's going to go there because it's about them, that I can get down on.
Agreed, yes.
If he wants to speak up because he feels... Yeah, then it's hard for him to hold it in.
Self-righteous, I'm going
to get over that. If this is something for your heart, stop being so full of yourself. There are kids in the situation that you need to start caring about more than you, more than your sister, more than your mom, unfortunately.
And it won't fix until that mom, the daughter, is ready to fix it.
Yeah.
And
she may not think anything's wrong right now. Four kids, deadbeat boyfriend, who they cheat on him too.
Yeah, why don't they understand our morals?
Yeah, exactly. Right? Conscience. Brr.
Yeah, it's ingrained in everybody.
You see that tree? Doesn't that tell you to stop doing that?
Jeez. Man, I mean, could I not find a better example of why that article was stupid? Here we go.
God, that was a podcast statement.
Secular's response is, your nieces and nephews aren't suffering. They're safe and supervised by their imposed-upon grandmother, who seemed to be unable to tell her daughter that she refuses to be taken advantage of any longer. I see no reason to hesitate to say something. The next time your mother calls to vent, by all means, speak up. Now, I think that's extremely one-sided. She knows the deal. She knows she's being imposed upon, and she knows she's being taken advantage of. But actually, sometimes, that's just what you're called to do.
Yeah.
That there is parts of life that are ugly.
Yep.
And there is a God that says, I'm there in the ugly. I knew it was coming. I'm sorry it's ugly. But, like, sometimes being taken advantage of is just part of your gig because it's better for someone else. I was talking to my kids about this week, and I asked them what love was. And really what it could boil down to is when you choose someone over yourself.
Yeah.
Otherwise, people don't even know. Like, how do they know that you love them unless you chose them over you at some point? Whether that be like how you spent your time, or that you used your money to buy them something, or the way that you spoke to them. Like, there's just an element of an unselfishness there is what love equals. And so and that's the truth of it. Like, the grandmother is loving on some kids, and being imposed upon and taken advantage of is her choosing them over her. That's what love is, and she's doing that. And while it's unfortunate that has to be the way and the conduit of which love is delivered to those kids, right now that's how she's doing it. And it's not a terrible thing for her to be taken advantage of in that way. And we characterize that of like a pride issue, a self-respect thing. It's like, do not allow yourself to be taken advantage of. Well, you know, sometimes that's the best way to love on somebody. And so depending on the person that you want to be, it's not necessarily a bad thing. Anyway, you're listening to Live from the Path on livefromthepath.org. Here's the deal. Sometimes we like to pick up the podcast, wrap it up in a tight little bow, put it in a bowling bag, and send it to people we don't know. And today, that's what we're going to do. So you've been listening to Live from the Path on www.livefromthepath.org. Be faithful in the means. God will handle the ends. And what does it matter with you,
baby? Hey, man, you got creepy quiet in this ending.
I know.
You said... All right, we got everything from... Well,
here's the deal. It's like I didn't prepare anything to say, and I have no reflexive memory where I've been saying it X number of ways for X number of years, and so I have to make it up as I go.
All of you who are still here, we appreciate you being here on the podcast with us.
Do you believe that?
You've been listening to Live from the Past.
Wait a minute, have you put any thought into how much you appreciate them, or are you just saying that to
lip service them? I appreciate them.
Like, how much time have you devoted to that this week?
I don't know, probably this week, maybe 2 or 3 minutes.
2 or 3 minutes.
That over the last couple years, that's a lot of minutes.
I don't know, Boo. That doesn't feel like love to me. You spent most of this week on yourself.
I didn't say I love.
Few amounts of time.
I never said I love everyone who's on our podcast. I said I appreciate them.
Here's the deal. Pray for Boo this week.
Life and Path with Mike.
Pray for Boo. He has some issues. That
he's got some good stuff to talk about on Life and Path.
Be faithful with the means. God will handle the end. Thanks for listening to Live from the Path.